So, a short while ago, one of my students asked me to listen to a talk, a teisho, by a Vipassana teacher on what was referred to as consciousness versus awareness. And then to help her understand better this subtle distinction between these. And I listened to the teisho and I thought it was quite good. It was spoken from a Theravada standpoint. You probably know the difference between Theravada and Mahayana, but I'll restate it. So Theravada is the original school of Buddhism. Theravada literally means elders, the elders, school of the elders, meaning the Buddha and his successors prior to the importation of Buddhism into the Orient, where a second school of Buddhism kind of organically arose called Mahayana. Now, I think there were also roots of Mahayana before then, but the primary difference between them is Theravada Buddhism views the end goal as nirvana for oneself. And each of us has the responsibility, not alone, because we must seek the help of others in this monumental task of coming to full awakening or nirvana, the responsibility to achieve that, to get there, to arrive there. So the Buddha made a statement on his deathbed with his closest disciples surrounding him. A wonderful statement, and it was this. He said, "All component things are subject to decay. Work out your own salvation with diligence." So this is kind of the underpinning, the philosophy, the direction of Theravada Buddhism. And from this school of Theravada Buddhism evolved teachings that in the West now are quite widely taught, and one of their core practices is called Vipassana. It's very, very similar to Zazen. I would say there's almost no difference. And the differences are subtle, but they're not unimportant. And that's what I wanted to go into today. So this Theravada teacher talked about consciousness as, correctly, one of the five skandhas. So what are the skandhas? The skandhas are the elemental units of what makes up the apparent concatenation of a being, so to speak. So the skandhas, the five skandhas, go like this. I think this is pretty close to what they are: form, sensation, perception, volition, or mental formation, and consciousness. Consciousness is kind of the top of that pyramid, so to speak. So we all know well one of the basic teachings of the Buddha, that there is no self. There's no separated entity. The Diamond Sutra goes into this beautifully. There's no separated entity, no personality, no individual. There is an apparent individual, an apparent person. We all know that person very well. But when we look very closely at it and try to find out what exactly it is, what we find, if we're very diligent in the search, are the skandhas, what's called the five heaps. Heaps in the sense that there are five things that are put together in various configurations to make up the concatenation, the appearance, the delusion of an individual. So this consciousness is at the top of this heap. So we start with sensation, or I'm sorry, with form. So form is this basic material stuff, you might say, this objective material stuff. Sensation is the very moment that we are aware, consciously aware of this stuff. Perception is then the next step where this awareness is named, recognized, perhaps even compared, judged. See how this goes step by step. The volition, the fourth skanda, is then all the things that come in to create the desire for something better, the wanting to avoid something that is painful, the entire movement of the mind towards certain things and avoiding other things is called volition. And then consciousness, we might say, is the supervening arrival at an awareness of an entity that knows all this, that is aware of the form, that then has a sensation, that then perceives something, that then has volition. And consciousness would be the most complete concatenation of all these forms. Now, each of these skandhas are impermanent, karmically bound, the result of cause and effect, and subject to what is called dependent arising. They do not, of their own, have any permanent stuffness to them, but arise dependently. So what does this mean? And what I'm doing here is actually restating some of the things from this talk by the Vipassana teacher. So what is sound, for example? What is sound? So sound is a vibration that meets the ear, sensory organ. So there is an event that occurs, there's a sensory organ that meets the event, and then something called hearing occurs. Now, from the standpoint of ordinary mind, when a tree falls in the woods and nobody hears it, it still makes a sound, and then when someone gets there, they hear this outside sound made by an outside, permanent, existing tree. But from the standpoint of deep introspection, which is what Buddhism is, deep introspection, sound is intimate, unique. It is your sound. And your sound arises, or your hearing, we should more correctly say, your hearing arises as a result of all the different factors that lead to it, including an event occurring, a sensory organ, and then a hearing occurs. And so all of these things are dependently arising, and none of them has separate existence. Remember what the sixth patriarch said now. He said from the very beginning, this was in a poem he wrote, where the fifth patriarch recognized him as the true, worthy recipient of the robe and bowl to become the sixth patriarch. So Wei Nung wrote this in his poem. One of the lines of the poem was, from the very beginning, not a single thing has ever existed, has ever stood apart. So this is another aspect of this dependent arising. Things don't stand apart from you, but what are you? This mind, this awareness, things don't stand apart. They're linked by it. So the Theravada teacher, just to cut to the chase, eventually, because this is part of the foundational aspect of Theravada Buddhism, painted the picture of consciousness as being this temporary phenomenon bound by karma, dependently arising with the object of consciousness, and then disappearing when the object of consciousness is gone, and that sometimes consciousness is here and sometimes it isn't. For example, sometimes we are conscious and sometimes we're in deep sleep, sometimes we're anesthetized, and when we die, that consciousness that we identify as we're aware of it, so in a sense it's an object, because you can be aware that you are conscious, that dies, goes away. So it's not permanent, it's not absolute, it's not fundamental, and it's not therefore nirvana. And nirvana, this teacher posited, was what awareness is. So he made a distinction between consciousness, which is dependently arising and has an object, and itself is the object of itself, one might say. You can become aware that you are conscious. And awareness is this something that can't be described in words. It's the underpinning, it's the fundamental. One might say consciousness might be like a wave off the ocean, and awareness is the ocean itself. Now the wave is all water, but it's water in a particular configuration. So the concatenation of all these skandhas leads to a wave that we identify with our name, our history, our desires, our associations, our memories, everything. And that's the illusion of a separated individuality, self, personality, the Buddha talked about in the Diamond Sutra. But this wave is water. So when the wave returns to the ocean and the skandhas just dissipate and there isn't attachment to it, which is the underpinning of how we transmigrate through lifetime after lifetime, this wave becomes what it always originally was, which was the ocean. So in this conception, the ocean is awareness. So you can see that there's a distinction between the two, and it's quite useful, but, and this is not coming from a feeling of superiority or a feeling attached to our particular approach, but in the Zen school, that is not the whole story. It's not the whole story. It's very important, it's very critical, but it's the first step. So this wave returning to the ocean is, in a sense, the first step in the progress of a Zen student doing this profound introspection called Zazen, working with koan, working with the teacher. So in Zen, the conception goes beyond this, goes beyond it. And the reason that I'm bringing this up now is not theoretical, it's not philosophical. It's only because it can be very, very helpful to your individual practice. Otherwise, why would any Zen teacher bring it up? The Zen path is not about philosophizing. It's a very practical approach to your life. It's about freeing yourself of suffering in becoming what you truly are. So I'm going to try to go into this a little bit. Now I'm going to start with a Zen master, Dogen, and a famous statement that he made in order to try to elucidate how we go beyond this concept of awareness as nothing but an oceanic emptiness. So Dogen had a profound personal question. It bothered him greatly. It probably was the deep motivation for him to go from Japan to China, seek out the teachings of Chinese masters, Zen Mat Chan masters, and bring this teaching back to Japan and teach for the rest of his life. He died rather young, in his 60s, maybe 59. But he was viewed as a brilliant Zen master, dialectician, writer. He was motivated by this question. Now, he called it, and also wrote a book by this title, his Genjo Koan. Genjo Koan. So we all know what a koan is. It's a question, or it's actually a case record. A case record. But in the context of how we work with these stories or case records in Zen, they are deep questions. They involve inquiry. And Genjo is life of one's own life. So the koan of your personal life, not the one assigned to you by the teacher, not the one in order in the Mumon Kan that you're working on as part of your training, but your Genjo koan is, and not everyone has one, perhaps they're not conscious of it, your profound deep inner question. For example, there was a Catholic philosopher, Paul Tillich, and I've mentioned this before. His Genjo koan, he encountered in his reading, and it grabbed him and wouldn't let him go. And it was the question, why is there something rather than nothing at all? That's a profound Genjo koan. Now others might ask themselves, why is there suffering? Here's this world, God created it. You know, there's an underlying perfection, but why is there suffering? Why did there have to be suffering? This thing that none of us can escape, that is so difficult to accept. Other people have, and there was a Zen student who came to Philip Kaplow or Yasutani Roshi. This is in the Three Pillars of Zen. His question is, what is reality? And he came to kind of his own awakening before he even encountered Zen, and then deepened it through his Zen practice, working with this profound question, what is reality? What is real? What is true? So what was Dogen's Genjo koan? Well, here it is. And it's actually, it's a koan of its own. So Dogen was tormented by this question. He went to his teacher. This was, I believe, in China, one of his Chan masters, and said to his teacher, why, if Buddha nature is our birthright, if we intrinsically possess Buddha nature, why did all the Buddhas and Bodhisattvas and patriarchs have to struggle so hard to come to enlightenment? It's a good question, isn't it? If it's your birthright, I mean, Buddhism teaches that, all beings have Buddha nature. Why does one have to struggle so hard to come to enlightenment? And the master answered him, because they, these patriarchs, Buddhas, Bodhisattvas, because they were conscious of their enlightenment. How interesting. Why, if Buddha nature is our birthright, did all the Buddhas and patriarchs have to struggle so hard to come to enlightenment? Master answers, because they were conscious of their enlightenment. What does this mean? So, what is enlightenment? It's even a more fundamental question. What is it? So, we tend to, you know, think when we first encounter this school of Zen, that enlightenment is some perfected state. There are halos and rainbows associated with it. There is a profound peace and nirvana, and people who have this emanate something special, and we greatly emulate them and want to be like them, and also put our teachers on a pedestal, put fellow students who have had some measure of awakening on a pedestal, and make it something very rare, very special. And we begin to objectify it. So, in a sense, at this stage, we are conscious of enlightenment, and we're conscious of a picture we have of enlightenment. But what is this really? What are we talking about here? What are we talking about? So in this process of being so-called conscious of enlightenment, what's happening is that we're making a distinction, we're making a dividing line, we're splitting something that is intrinsically one, all beings are Buddha nature, one might say, into two. We have an object, whatever it may be, including enlightenment, and a subject. An object and a subject. This is that consciousness again, as the Theravada teacher talked about. This consciousness, this something that is my object. And as a result of it being my object, there must be a me. So I begin to stand apart from the so-called objective world. And I define myself in some way. Perhaps I am out to the very edges of the border of my skin. I am what I am aware of. I am what I can move and control. And whatever I can't is outside. It's the outside world. Now, when we do Zazen, we begin to peer deeply into the actuality of our experience. In fact, we start with what we are calling in this split-up world, the object. We start with the object. So we start with, for example, counting the breath or following the breath. And we observe it very, very closely. We observe it intimately. Intimately. And we begin to gradually and then sometimes suddenly notice something about this so-called object. First, we notice that it seems to be continually changing. It's never the same from one moment to the next. It's ever changing. And a deeper observation of it begins to reveal that it, one might say, is something we missed initially. We missed that. We were caught up in what it was, in what this object was, and all our descriptions of it. Remember the skandhas now. We started with form and then added sensation, the awareness of the form, the glimmer of awareness that there's an experience happening, and then a perception, which is the naming of this thing, and then the comparison and the desire to change it, and then the overall sensation that there was an entity doing this, which we call consciousness. Now, what can we do in this situation in our Zazen? We observe this so-called object, we notice a continual changing of the object, and yet at the same time, we can be aware not just of the object, but of its fact. So what I will sometimes say is we are making a subtle move in our Zazen. First, not quite consciously, and then we can be conscious of this. The subtle change is going from what this is, its particularities, which involve our mind, comparison, naming, and consciousness, all those things, all the skandhas, all the volition involved, the desire and everything else that the Buddha talked about in the Four Noble Truths. We go from what it is, its particularities, one, two, three, or the following of the breath, observing it, seeing its changing nature, to that it is. That it is. From what it is to that it is. What do I mean by that? It's not that what it is stops when one is aware of that it is. It's that one has shifted attention from particularities that we've identified to fact. Fact. So let's go over this a little more closely. What it is requires a stopping, kind of stopping. At the moment something is perceived, one might say we have, in that moment, if we intimately observe it, stopped the world. We've stopped it. The world has duration. It's a very, very slight, tiny duration. Quantum physics is called Planck time. It's the shortest duration possible. I forget how it's measured exactly, but it has to do with something called Planck length, which is the shortest length. So in other words, things are not infinitely short and infinitely brief. So this sensation the world is flowing and continuing, and we're chasing after it, trying to make it better. In our intimate zazen, we begin to notice the stopping of the world. There's a duration to things. Now, the Buddha talked about this. This is really amazing. In the early sutras, the Buddha used the term ksana, K-S-A-N-A. A ksana is a thought moment, a thought moment. And he said that the world is actually a series of thought moments. They're extremely brief. I forget what his measurement was. It's prior to quantum physics, obviously, but I think it was something like a thought moment was 360 thousandths of a second. So exceedingly brief. But the Buddha, through deep introspection, realized that what seemed to be this flowing, continual outside world of experience, sensation that we could name and then try to manipulate was actually a moment by moment, almost like a movie frame. Movie frame after movie frame after movie frame. Of done, done, done. Stop, 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 stop. When we have deep introspection. Now, what is the implication of this, and how is this leading towards this step beyond that Zen takes, beyond this attachment to a pure state called nirvana? If it's done, then there's nothing. First, that we need do about it. Secondly, that we can do about it. In our state of observation, in our state of mindfulness, I'm not talking about in the actual world where things are approximations and we have goals and this keeps us alive to get to our next zazen sitting. I'm talking about in this state of wanting to find out, asking the profound Genjo Koan, why did all these masters have to struggle so hard to come to enlightenment? It's done. And remember, done is a root of the word perfect. Perfect. Fect means to do or done, and per is through. So my teacher Richard Clark used to say, things are perfect because they're done all the way through. So this is the doneness of the world. This is what I call stopping the world. When in your profound zazen, you are allowing the sensations moment by moment, and observing their doneness. They could have been many ways, but at the moment of my awareness of them, my consciousness of them, they declare themselves as this one thing in this moment. And that's called collapsing the cloud of probability. Now, I get that, and then I get that it's done. And that any attempt to entangle with it, grapple with it, manipulate it, is futile. I put that down. I just stay with the doneness of my experience moment after moment after moment. And I can't think of a better description for mindfulness than that. Being with the doneness of one's momentary sensations. The doneness. Moment by moment by moment. Now, whether or not I am aware of this, it is actually the fact. The fact. Fact, too, has to do with this doneness. So what do I do with that? I become aware, if I'm no longer grappling with the fact, trying to manipulate it, name it, compare it, set it up against a template of what I imagine to be perfection, but now see it as done all the way through, therefore intrinsically perfect. Intrinsically. Remember, why if everyone intrinsically has Buddha nature? Intrinsically perfect. Intrinsically done. Then there's only one thing left to do. And that's to notice it is. To notice it is. What does that mean now? To notice it is. That it is means that it appears. It appears in my center. It is a personal, intimate appearance. It's intimate. Now, what is the difference between appearance and this done sensation? Where is the dividing line? We have to look back to see this, deeply look back. Is there a dividing line? Is there a difference between the form and the fact? Now remember, this Zen master of Dogen said that all the Buddhas and Bodhisattvas had to struggle so hard to come to awakening, to come to enlightenment, because they were conscious of their enlightenment. They were standing apart from their enlightenment. What does it mean to stand apart from your enlightenment? What is your enlightenment? This is a question we asked initially. What is your enlightenment? Perhaps your enlightenment is this very doneness, the awareness of the doneness of the world, its perfection, its as it isness, its thusness. When the world is thus, and at the same time is there any need for a knower, an entity standing apart, conscious of it? Is there need for a person, a personality, an entity, a concatenation of the skandhas to stand apart from this doneness of perfection, moment by moment by moment? If there's no need for an entity because being is intrinsic to things, so this done moment we notice is. But that is not added on. It's not given to it by some other entity, namely myself. It's intrinsic to it. Is intrinsic to the world. Therefore, there's no need for being conscious of it because it stands alone, and that's called absolute. It stands alone. It doesn't stand outside. It stands alone. Remember the sixth patriarch said, from the very beginning not a single thing has ever stood outside. But there is no outside or inside in this state. There is just. Now you see how the attachment to a notion of awareness is some purity, some absence of form, color, sound, smell, taste, touch, is actually maintaining a kind of dividing line between it and the world of form or sensation that then can very easily become the so-called dirty world to be gotten rid of, getting in the way of this purity, getting in the way of this samadhi. And there's a very fine line between that and religious intolerance and nihilism and anarchism and all the things we see going on in the world now, where the world of form is by some people viewed as bad, wrong, dirty, to be rejected, and there's some pure state that I will achieve after I get rid of this world. I'll go to that pure place, that pure land. Zen is very, very scrupulous in avoiding that, avoiding it. Not being attached to one's awakening, not being conscious of one's enlightenment, not making it into something other than the moment by moment stopped perfect awareness of each thing as it is. Let me read a koan to you. So this is from the Hekigan Roku. I'm going to read it only because it's short and pithy, and kind of addresses directly what I've been talking about. So this is number 86, and I've read this before in some Teisho, maybe a year or two ago. But the koan is called Uman's Everyone Has His Own Light. And it goes like this. Uman, this great Tang Dynasty Zen master, said to the assembly, "Everyone has his own light, though when you try to see it, you cannot. Everything is darkness." It's turning that light of the mind back to see in this profound state where we can put down the moment-by-moment description of the world, what it is, and begin to notice that it is. And we notice that it is means that it appears in one's deepest center, which is intimate. And then we peer into that intimacy. We go into that kind of samadhi. When we go into that samadhi, we have no particularities, no sound, no color, no time, no whatever it might be. We have none of that. It's like we're entering this vast ocean, this oceanic thing. So Uman addresses this and says, everyone has his own light. This intimate thing is intimate. Though when you try to see it, you cannot. Everything is darkness. It cannot be your object. You cannot be conscious of your enlightenment. If you are, it's not yet true enlightenment. Yagyu Saki said that. She wrote to her teacher, Harada Roshi, after a series of deep enlightenments, I've come to see clearly that as long as we are conscious of our enlightenment, it is not yet true enlightenment. It's exactly what Dogen's teacher was saying to him. So he said, what is everybody's light? Uman asked this now. So this is the little hook here in this koan. What is everybody's light? He answered himself, saying, the temple storeroom, the tower gateway. He also said, a precious thing isn't as good as nothing. Temple storeroom, the coolness of the air on one's skin, the waft of incense smell. How is this not your own life? How is this not intimate? How is it not appearing? How is it not stopped, therefore done all the way through? Therefore no need for any description, any changing of it, any objectifying of it in order to manipulate it. And yet it shines its own fact. It stands alone. Could that possibly be your own light? And then he says, a precious thing, this precious nirvana, this precious purity, this awareness that stands above and beyond consciousness, he says, isn't as good as nothing. So we'll end there today.